Thanks for the introduction.
Right, so there will not be active matter in this talk. I apologize for this, but I'm very curious to learn about it. Before I actually talk about correlation between surface structure and slippage and or flow of polymers over surfaces, let me just discuss a few seconds what I do otherwise. So I'm also interested in collective phenomena in membranes like fusion, the stalk formation here, or spreading of vesicles. I do directed self-assembly of polymers, where you try to replicate structures in block copolymer materials. And the third thing, which will be more closely related to what I will talk about here, is parameter passing techniques and development of simulation models. So what I want to talk today about is flow of polymers over surfaces and how you can go from a particle-based description to continuum models, typical hydrodynamic models.
My eyes and
that's very wrong with the projector.
Yeah, that the thing moves like this.
So when there was this earthquake in LA, the anchor couple disappeared below the table, and you saw background when this moving presentation. So this is active.
Yeah, but it's not wind, I checked. I mean, it's not oscillating the screen. Okay. So maybe somebody hears that. I mean, the person in the technique said, if I don't switch on my microphone, he will come and turn it on. I guess we should proceed for the moment. Okay, so then I will say something about the wetting behavior of these of polymers at surfaces. Then I will come to the dynamics and hydrodynamic boundary conditions at soft and hard surfaces and structured surfaces. And then I want to talk about directed motion of droplets on vibrating substrates. So we do computer simulations, and of course it's a very general statement that by changing the surface structure, you can tailor wettability and friction. And there are, of course, very many different aspects to it. One is, of course, this molecular aspect, where you change the chemistry at the surface. And one of the many examples here is this even-odd effect on fluorinated self-assembled monolayers, where due to the packing and the orientation of the dipole moments at the end of the chains, you can change the contact angle on top of that. On the very other range, you have sort of macroscopic behavior, where you look at the topography of the substrate, and you have macroscopic wetting behavior. You can look at the pinning of the contact line, the Gibbs criterion, and thereby you can construct, like in this case here, these amphiphobic surfaces, which are both repellent to hydrophilic and hydrophobic substances. So computer simulations are sort of in between, especially the ones we will talk about in the following, which are coarse-grained computer simulations, so we don't deal with the real atomistic stuff. And the role of those computer simulations, or the aim there, is to identify how you go from the microscopic properties to the macroscopic properties, and what kind of parameters you want to pass from a particle-based description to a macroscopic description. And then once you have identified which parameters you want to pass, then you also need, of course, simulation techniques to extract those parameters. And then with this, then you can check whether the macroscopic predictions are valid or how they break down. And this is typically due to an interplay between length scales.
Thank you.
there will be less text on the next slide, so. Okay, I just continue for a moment.
See, in Hollywood they call this special effects.
Okay, so. Okay, so in the most basic case, if you have a droplet on a surface and you want to describe the macroscopic behavior, then what you need is the volume of the droplet and the contact angle. And the contact angle is, of course, given by Young's equation, which is a very simple balance of tensions at the three-phase contact line, where you have the tension between the solid and the vapor, the solid and the liquid, and the liquid-vapor tension. And so if you balance those tension parallels to the surface, you get the contact. You have a very similar equation. If this droplet moves over the surface, then you set up a velocity inside of this droplet, and you balance the friction at the solid substrate against the shear stress inside of the liquid. And that gives you the venerable hydrodynamic boundary conditions, the Navier slip condition from 1823, where here you have the stress on the liquid side, and here you have the stress of the friction. Okay. It has two parameters. Eta is the viscosity, V is, of course, the velocity, X and Y are the two Cartesian components. This term here, stress is proportional to a coefficient, the friction coefficient times velocity. And this length scale here is the slip length. And then you have another free parameter that is where you want to apply this boundary condition, which is the position of the boundary condition. You can calculate this friction coefficient by a Green-Kubo formula, like formulas you have for the viscosity. We look at the autocorrelation function of the forces between the solid and the liquid. This has been developed by Barat and Bouquet. You can even qualitatively understand where it comes from. So the slip length here is inversely proportional to the square of the interactions between the solid and the liquid, the structure factor of the liquid at the corrugation of the substrate, and the density. And if you you can use two different flow profiles, like wet flow or Poiseuille flow, pressure-driven flow or boundary-driven flow, in order to determine the velocity profile. You have two profiles, you have two parameters, you can extract these two parameters. If you do this for a normal polymer liquid at normal conditions, where the liquid condenses into a viscous fluid, then as you increase the strength of the interaction between the solid and the liquid, the slip goes down. It roughly follows this 1 over strength squared prediction, and you see that it is on the order of sigma, sigma being the typical segment size of the polymer. So then, of course, you can ask, okay, are these the parameters you want to have? You can augment them next to the contact angle. Of course, there's the interface potential, which tells you something about the interaction between the liquid vapor interface and the solid substrate. And you can also ask what is the position of this boundary condition, which is not included in this friction coefficient, and how you extract them from the simulations. So the simulations we use for the purpose of this talk is a very standard model, a bead spring model, Kramer-Gass type of thing. For the polymers, we use polymers basically because They are short polymers, they are non-entangled. They reduce vapor pressure such that we do not have to worry about evaporation effects. You have Leonard Jones beads with the attractive part of the potential such that the chains condense into a liquid which coexists with a vapor of vanishingly low vapor pressure and density. Monomers along the chain are bonded by this Fehner potential. So you have these three important interactions, the connectivity along the chain. So these are polymers. You have extruded volume, that's the repulsive part of the Lennard-Jones potential. And you need the attractive part of to condense them into a liquid. And you have then a surface. The surface are typically Lennard-Jones solid, two layers of them, and there are attractive interactions with a different Lennard-Jones potential such that we can tune the contact angle. We mainly do MV simulations and we use the DPV thermostat in order to conserve momentum when you want to study flow. So, I mean, this part of the polymer model is well established. There's nothing special about that. Then, of course, you can start trying to extract those parameters. The first one is, of course, the contact angle. It's a very bad idea to measure contact angles from droplets for several reasons. I mean, first of all, droplets in computer simulations are small, so you would have line tension effects. The first line tension effects you can get rid of by looking at actually ridges and not droplets. Forgot to mention this. Should do this here. So this is a typical droplet there, and it's not round, but it spans the system in the periodic boundary conditions perpendicular to the plane here. Which means that if you change the droplet size, the length of that three-phase contact line does not change, and so you don't get this line tension effect. But still, sort of, if you would look at density contours, then of course they will bend around here in the vicinity of the three-phase contact line. It's very hard to determine from that geometry the contact angle. Much better is it to use Young's equation, just measure the surface tension, which has the advantage that it gets rid of these droplet size effects because you macroscopically separate the solid liquid and the liquid vapor interface from each other. And there are various methods how to do this. A very nice one is grand canonical simulations, where you fix the chemical potential and then look at the free energy as a function of composition at fixed chemical potential, the probability of observing a certain composition in your system. At coexistence, these probability distributions, I mean, this is the negative logarithm of the probability, has two minima of equal weight, indicating that vapor and liquid coexist with each other. So from this, you get the coexistence densities. And then if the system tunnels from the vapor to the liquid, it forms a liquid slab in between with two interfaces. There's a free energy associated with the free energy with those two interfaces, which you can just read off from this probability distribution. And the fact that this part of the probability distribution is flat indicates that you can move the interfaces with respect to each other, and they do not interact, so you really get twice the interfacial tension of those independent interfaces. You can do the same trick, of course, with boundaries. So you add surfaces to the system, and then the system tunnels from a microscopically thin enrichment layer of liquid to a system which is completely filled with liquid. And this gives you just the difference of those two surface tensions here, which you can just read off from the difference of the minimum close to the wall and far away from the wall. You also see that there's some structure here in the probability distribution of the free energy as a function of the amount of absorbed liquid, and that is the interface potential, right? So as the liquid vapor interface moves away from the substrate, there is a non-trivial shape of the free energy, and that's this interface potential. You can extract it from the grand canonical simulations, and by this you can estimate what is the order of the wetting transition, for example. And this has been done by us and Jeff Arrington quite extensively. And from then, this interface potential from the minimum close to the wall, you can also extract the surface, the contact angle. Now, what is nice, you can use then this interface potential, therefore you want to have it, in order to write down a free energy functional, a standard form. Siegfried Dieters has also worked a lot on it, where you describe the free energy of such a liquid vapor interfacial profile on a surface by just the tension of with a solid, the liquid vapor interface, and the interaction between the liquid vapor interface and the substrate. So that's all fine. It's just not going to work for realistic substances, because the problem is that if you want to do this with grand canonical simulations, you will not be able to do this, because it's very hard to insert something realistic into a dense liquid. So if you would have an atomistic model, and if you would sort of want to apply the same computational strategy to, say, self-assembled monolayers or something like that, and an atomistic alkane melt on it, or polystyrene for that purpose, it's not going to work, because simply technically the grand canonical simulations won't work. So therefore, it would be much nicer to have an alternative technique. And the alternative technique to measure interfacial tensions is, of course, to integrate the anisotropy of the pressure across an interface, right? And you can also try to do the same thing for the interface potential here. So you look at basically a liquid film on top of a structured surface, and then you do a virtual deformation such that the volume of the liquid remains constant, and sort of you spread the liquid a little bit further on the solid substrate. So if you do the same thing in the bulk, then that would give you directly the contribution of the surface tension of this liquid slab. In this case here, if you do this, you will get the surface tensions, that's understood, plus the interaction, plus this extra term. So basically, you get the Legendre transformation of the interface potential if you do this. And if you write it down microscopically, then you get basically the integral of the difference of the normal and tangential pressure across the film. That is what the virial would give you. Plus, you have these extra terms which involve the interactions between the surface atoms and the liquid. And this is due to the fact that if you spread the liquid on that surface, of course, you scale only the coordinates of the liquid, but not the coordinates of the solid, right? But those two terms you can measure easily in the simulations. They don't refer to grand canonical simulations. And that gives you then the Legendre transformation of the interface potential. And if you do this, then curves typically look like that. So this is plots of the interface potential or the Legendre transformation of it as a function of the thickness of the liquid film. The points with the error bars as the simulation data, you fit a curve to it and do the Legendre transformation, and you get the interface potential. And the two graphs here are for different attractive strengths between the solid and the liquid. You see that this minimum moves up, indicating that the contact angle becomes smaller. You also see that there's a hump in this interface potential, indicating that the wetting transition is of first order. Then you...
If you find here this thickness of the film, then you have to accompany by definition what you mean by thickness.
Right.
So that will influence the value of the potential.
Right, absolutely. We use the integral criteria, not a crossing one. And the reason is, and you will see this here as well, the continuum description is, of course, good as long as you have a continuum film. But of course, you have layering effects at the solid, right? They cannot be reproduced, at least by this form. You would need a density functional theory for that. So if you compare, then these are droplet profiles for this contact angle here. You see this is a microscopic prediction with the macroscopic contact angle, the cap-shaped form. This is the deviation due to the interface potential. You see that with this interface potential, you describe it better, but you see these jumps in the average density profiles, and they're not reproduced, but you get sort of the leaking out of the liquid at this three-phase contact line. It is still an interesting problem how to define sort of the interface potential in these jumps regions there. And the other interesting problem, which I did not mention, but was in the other slide before, we had a long discussion whether you should put here this square root also in front of this interface potential or not. So some people do, some people don't. The numerics would indicate it works better if you don't.
I would agree.
We should discuss this maybe later, because it really depends how you define the distance between the solid substrate and the liquid vapor interface, whether you go straight up or whether you go normal to this interface. I mean, in principle, you should treat those two interfaces symmetrically. Okay, so that was about the statics. One point more is, of course, you can put the droplet onto a soft substrate, and the soft substrate in the following I'd like to discuss is a polymer brush. So you just graph those polymers on the surface. And in fact, you have something like autophobicity. So even so, the Lennard-Jones interactions or the polymers are the same of the brush and the liquid will de-wet from that polymer brush because it cannot penetrate into the densely grafted brush. Okay. That's one thing. So you see droplets on top of a brush which is chemically identical, so to say. You see this also in experiments. The other thing is, of course, then you have to balance the forces not only parallel to the surface but also perpendicular to them. And this can give rise to the lifting up of this three-phase contact line or this formation of a ridge, which has been predicted by Shanahan and Carré a while ago. So we tried to develop a similar interface Hamiltonian for this as well. You can look at how the brush surface deforms. In this case, I should say it is important that the brush liquid is a compressible liquid. That sort of distinguishes it from other approaches. And you can also then look at the surface tension of the brush, which is very close to the surface tension of the liquid vapor interface. Then indeed, we do observe this lifting up. However, I have to say we were quite disappointed. It's a very small effect. You see that the rim is sort of long-ranged perturbed. The prediction is it should decay logarithmically, at least it's long range, so it goes out to 50 sigma, which is a lot. But the effect predicted is actually even smaller than what we observed. But in any case, the height of the ridge is only on the order of the diameter sigma. So, so far to that. And then we took the same system and started to move the droplets over those surfaces, right? And the typical sketch is here. So we look at sort of the bottom of the surface. So we have the polymer liquid. Here you have the brush. These are the grafting points. And now you start sliding those surfaces up and down in the squared geometry. And of course, you can look at velocity profiles. Now the grafting surface is here to the right, and this is the center of the film. And you get linear velocity profiles at the center, as you would expect for wet flow. And then you can ask, well, does the velocity of the polymer liquid reaches the velocity of the polymer brush? And at intermediate and high grafting densities, yes, it does so. At low grafting densities, there's a finite amount of slip, so the polymer liquid is always a little bit lower in velocity than the surface, which is here indicated by the horizontal line. Then the next thing is, where is the hydrodynamic boundary condition? naively, you could just extrapolate the velocity profile and see where it hits the wall, and then say this is the hydrodynamic boundary condition, or the position of the hydrodynamic boundary condition. It's quite obvious that it sort of fails, because according to the standard definition, if you had slip, the velocity profile would reach the velocity of the wall behind the wall. Here it reaches it before the wall, which would correspond to a negative slip length, and this doesn't work with the Green-Kubo formula, of course. So in this case, it's really important to locate both the slip length as well as the position of the hydrodynamic boundary condition. Therefore, we use these two types of flow, Couette and Poisson flow. Okay. If you do this, here I just wrote down again the hydrodynamic boundary condition with the two parameters, the slip length and the position. Then you can just work out macroscopically how the velocity profile in Poisson and Couette flow would look like. These are sort of the two simplest flow, where you would also not expect dramatic things due to, say, non-locality effects of the viscosity which you may have. You can, and the recipe is sort of, you take the velocity profile far away from the surface, you fit a linear curve for a Couette, a parabolic curve for Poisson flow, and you determine where it hits the velocity of the wall. It gives you two positions, and out of those two positions, you can extract the slip length, and you can extract the position of the hydrodynamic boundary profile. So if you do this at a rather high grafting density, then you see here the profile of the Couette flow. You determine that it hits the velocity of the wall, zero in this case. Here you see the velocity profile of the Couette flow. It's linear, you extrapolate it. Those two extrapolation lengths agree with each other. So this part here is zero. The slip length is zero. You get a stick boundary condition. That's what you will expect. If you do this, however, for the case that the grafting density is not terribly high, and you have a density profile between the polymer brush and the polymer melt, and the width of the interface is rather broad, right? Then you can again do the fit for the Poisson and for the Couette flow, and you see that the order of those points is reversed. So the position where the Couette flow hits is closer to the grafting surface than the Poisson flow, which makes this term here negative, indicating that this hydrodynamic boundary condition will fail. I mean, formally it would sort of predict an imaginary slip length, which is, of course, nonsense. But what it means is that with these two parameters, position of the boundary condition and slip length, you cannot consistently describe both Couette and Poisson flow. OK? And the system has several features. That failure of the Navier slip boundary condition, however, is not associated with the fact that this is a polymer brush and a polymer liquid. It is quite general. If you do have a surface, a substrate, a surface layer, and a bulk layer, and you have a different viscosity in the surface layer than you would have in the bulk. So if you just take standard hydrodynamic formulas, Navier-Stokes equation plus boundary conditions, such that the velocity vanishes at the substrate, that at this boundary between the surface layer and the bulk, the velocity and the stress is continuous, then of course you can solve on an envelope what the velocity profiles look like for Couette and Poisson flow, and you can extract those two characteristic points here, for Couette and Poisson flow. And if you do this, you get the following formula for the slip lengths. The length of the slip length is set by the thickness of the boundary region, which is the only relevant length scale. And then you have the ratio of the viscosities of the bulk liquid and the surface liquid. And of course, it makes a lot of sense if the surface zone has a low viscosity, so it acts like a lubricant, then this term here becomes large, and the slip length becomes large, and this is what you would expect. However, if the surface viscosity is higher, then this term here turns out to be negative, and that's exactly what we observed before. So this is sketched here. The velocity profiles don't look somehow strange. They look, I mean, there's no singularity, or if I would just show you the velocity profile for Couette or for Soilflow individually, you would not suspect anything strange, but nevertheless, both types of flow cannot be described by these two parameters. Okay, and one question would be, by what would you would have to replace the boundary condition in order to account for this? I mean, a layer model would do, but one could think of other things like gradient. There's another thing which is special to this polymer brush melt interface, which is related to the fact that these are polymers. So if you do look at the velocity profile in Poisson and Couette flow, then this is the parabolic one far away from the surface. But of course, you can also look at the velocity profile of the polymer brush. And this velocity profile is shown here. Of course, you should argue, well, the polymer brush is nailed down to the surface, and the surface in this plot has velocity zero, so better the velocity of the brush is zero. And of course, it's true that if you sit on a bead and sort of average the velocity of the bead, it is zero. But you can still ask the question, if the bead is further away from the surface, what is its velocity? And sort of what you would expect, if it dangles out into the melt, it sort of has a velocity which goes along with it. That also implies, of course, that if it is closer to the surface, that because the total velocity of the bead has to be zero, it has to be negative. And that is actually what we, of course, observe. So if you zoom in into this surface region here, what you see is that this is the sort of flux of the polymer brush. This averages out to zero. That's the total velocity here, which has this negative region in the vicinity of the surface. Right. You see this both for both types of flows. It's only dependent on the shear rate at the brush melt interface. So you can, of course, ask, why is this, right? So naively you would think, okay, if I shear the brush, then it would just tilt a little bit by a constant angle. And it has been suggested that this is like the flow through the polymer brush is like flow through a porous medium, which would sort of indicate that there may be a higher viscosity, which would agree with the previous one. But the chains do not simply tilt. You can look at the angle fluctuations of such a chain. So if this is sort of the flow direction, you look at those angles here. And these angular probability distribution as a function of the angle is shown here. And as you increase the shear rate or the Weisenberg number, then you see that it's distinctly non-Gaussian and it develops as 1/sin² wings of the probability distribution. So that indicates that they are not just slightly tilted. You could, of course, also look at the motion of the individual molecules, and this has been discussed for individual molecules like DNA on surfaces, of course. If you put them into shear flow, then they tumble around. And the nice thing is you see the same tumbling motion here even inside of the brush, even so it's a dense environment. The chains cannot cross through each other in the MD simulation. And if you follow this, then you see that the chain end sort of circulates around this, indicating that if it is further up, then it's sort of convective as a flow, and if it's further down, it compensates for this. You can then, of course, look at sort of velocity profiles. So the grafting point of the chain is here. This is the color code indicates the position of the chain end. So it is tilted on average. And then these arrows sort of indicate the velocity of the chain end. And you see this rotational flow there. The question is, of course, can you use this? Well, if you can manage to confine a particle in this part of the polymer brush here, right? Then even so you shear the liquid on top from left to right, this particle moves from right to left in the opposite direction. And that is sort of shown here. It's sort of very hard to confine a particle in this region. So our suggestion would be to use amplifiers, where you have a head group which strongly attracts to the surface but can still laterally move, and then has a tail which dangles into this region of the polymer brush. And if you do this, then indeed you do observe that those particles are transported against the flow direction, and the velocity of those particles is just proportional to the Weisenberg number or to the shear rate at the brush melt interface. I should say it's a small effect. I mean, this coefficient between the shear rate and this velocity, and you need a length scale, which is the end-to-end distance of the polymers, 10 to the minus 5, but it's qualitatively, right? It moves in the other direction. Good. Okay, with this, I sort of skip those soft surfaces and come to topographically structured surfaces. And there, of course, we looked at two-dimensional grooves, which have a certain height and a width. And you can have two states of the liquid in this configuration. Either you trap air inside of the grooves, which is called the Cassie state, or you fill it with liquid, which is the Wenzel state. And I mean, the transition between those two states has been discussed quite intensively. And also, I should say, in the simulations I will present in the following, we took great care that the pressure is always at the coexistence pressure, so such that if you are in this Cassie state, the liquid doesn't bulge into these grooves here. And in this, under those conditions, you would expect that the friction is strongly reduced in this state, because basically only the contact between the solid and the liquid contributes to the friction. I should say that, of course, since we do MD simulations, we are not in this regime where you have macroscopic grooves, but we have microscopic grooves. Therefore, you should rather think of the grooves we have, the typical dimension of few Lennard-Jones diameter, to be sort of at this crossover between this macroscopic description, where you would expect that there's a strong reduction of friction, and a microscopic description, which would be more like you have a rough surface, right? I mean, you had a surface with humps and valleys, and of course, then you would expect something else. But before I come to this, I put in another slide with people from Stuttgart, Alberto, where we look at, in this term, the macroscopic filling of those grooves as you go from the Cassie to the Wenzel state.
As you mentioned, data from Stuttgart, it starts to vibrate.
So, I mean, in this macroscopic filling, there's still, we found one interesting thing. So what is shown here is sort of how the groove is filled. And these are snapshots. So blue indicates liquid, yellow is the vapor phase. And you go from sort of the groove is filled with vapor, which is this Cassie state, to the Wenzel state. And we did it such that the free energy along those paths is minimal, which is called the minimum free energy path. And there are two pathways you can follow. One is the one you would expect, so if the liquid-vapor interface just moves down, right, and then it touches the bottom, and that's it, which is the black curve here. So first, the energy goes a little bit up because the contact angle is such that the contact between the liquid and the substrate is not favorable compared to vapor and substrate, but the liquid-vapor interface basically has the same length, so you move up. And then as the liquid-vapor interface goes down, it sees the bottom, and you sort of destroy the liquid-vapor interface, and you gain the free energy of this liquid-vapor interface. The other pathway under the same conditions, which is, and which of the two pathways is more favorable depends on the pressure, is that the liquid-vapor interface goes down, then you break the left-right symmetry, And the liquid first touches down on the right corner here, and then the left corner, the bubble sort of is squeezed out. And depending on where you are, one or the other one is more favorable. Okay. And that's the only microscopic thing I want to talk about.
How does it disappear? Is it dissolved in the liquid, or is this like two-phase consistent?
These are Ginzburg-Landau. These are not simulation results. I mean, Alberto has this in simulation results, and there, I mean, Lange-Jones liquids, no polymers, and there, sort of, there's a reservoir on top, which sort of acts as a reservoir for the liquid, and it's a compressible. So
physically, do you expect that this vapor bubble in the wedge would get dissolved in the liquid, or does it be squeezed out at the end part?
Well, I mean, since there are no vapor particles, but they're just not there, it's just the compressibility. So I guess your language, it would be dissolved. Okay. So then we tried to find this transition in our microscopic wedges. So they just have a few Lange-Jones diameters, as you can see here. And we don't find a transition whatsoever, just not first order. I mean, before that, you would expect, well, there was a hump in the free energy, so you would expect two peaks in the probability distribution. There are no peaks. You can change the attraction between the solid and the liquid, and it simply goes from something which is filled by vapor to something which is filled with liquid, and there's no two-peak structure in between. Okay, and this is just due to the fact that it is a microscopic system, right? Okay, but then you can still ask the same question than before. Now I put my liquid on top of it, and what is the friction? I mean, microscopically, you would expect that the friction is strongly reduced. And where is the aerodynamic boundary condition, right? And people before that sort of argued, if you had sort of these macroscopic description, the boundary condition is either here at the top or between the top and the bottom of those corrugations. Okay, that's not what we find. Our hydrodynamic boundary condition is above. So this is the position of the hydrodynamic boundary condition. Zero means the top level of those corrugations here, and it's systematically above. And it sort of has also a pretty intuitive interpretation. So if you look at the velocity profile as the liquid slips over this corrugated surface, then this corrugated surface sort of imposes some undulations, which die out as you go away from the surface. And sort of this dying out length scale sets you where the hydrodynamic boundary condition is. So there, I mean, this is the velocity profile as a function of the distance from the surface. Here you see this deviation. And here where the microscopic velocity profile agrees nicely with the Poisson microscopic one far away from the surface. That's the hydrodynamic boundary condition. It's also nice to see that if the corrugations become wider, then the decay length becomes larger, and therefore the hydrodynamic boundary condition is further away from the top than it is for the more narrow corrugated groups. Good. Then we looked at friction. And if you look at friction, the first thing is, well, for those microscopically corrugated groups, there's not much difference between the surface which has grooves or which don't have grooves. So if you would take the macroscopic prediction, only the top flat parts contribute to the friction, then you would get this green line here. So the friction is the friction on the flat surface times the surface fraction of that flat surface. And our friction constants are systematically above. And also, I mean, we have these two types of corrugations and the flat surface, and there's not much difference, right? If you think about it, maybe it's not too surprising, because if you sort of go onto the very microscopic part, then of course this thing here just looks like roughness. And roughness, what roughness does is it increases the friction, of course. And so you are sort of in between those two limits. And if you look more carefully at this, then you can describe, I mean, we have three data points here, the friction sort of as a friction from this Cassie state plus a contribution from the edge. Okay? There are a few data points to support this, but sort of each edge sort of produces an extra contribution to the friction. You can also see this in the density profiles, which are shown here. You see this layering around the edge of this corrugation. You also see that this layering is asymmetric if the liquid flows from the left to the right. And what is nice is that sort of the extra friction of this edge is in a physically reasonable range. So it's about the friction that three or four layers of atoms would produce. So I think so. Basically, you should think of it sort of as a first correction as you go from the macroscopic behavior back to finer corrugations. That would be the first correction. Okay. And the last example I have is we changed the shape of the substrate. So we have now this asymmetric sort of wedges, and we would follow the polymer droplet on top, and then we start to shake the substrate up and down. And then, I mean, since you have energy input and asymmetric potentials, these things start to run in one direction. And then the question was, what are the driving mechanisms for this motion? What is the flow inside of the droplet, and how is the energy dissipated?
The arrow over there, it's not the direction of motion. The direction of motion, I guess, should be opposite.
Good. Yes. I mean, it took us a while, I mean, to figure out why they run in the opposite direction, but they do run in the opposite direction. There are two types of driving mechanism. One is...
These are the rebels.
Which are the rebels?
Rebels.
Exactly. So one is contact line hysteresis. That is sort of easier to understand. And the other one is, of course, that you have also driving at the whole contact area. And this works as follows. So, I mean, you can look at the interactions between the liquid and the substrate. And so in the first period, you push the substrate up. You run into the repulsive, harsh repulsion of the Lennard-Jones. Therefore, there's, of course, a force from the left to the right. That is fine. And you see this also in the velocity profiles, that there's something in this. And then if it goes down, then sort of you see the attractions. And since the whole droplet, as you vibrate it, is somehow lifted up a little bit, the attraction then, and therefore you move to the other direction. If you don't believe this, of course, you can just look at, sort of isolate this mechanism by looking in a thin film. The top surface is just smooth, and the other one has this vibrating substrate, and then you can look at the velocity profile, so you don't have contact line driving, but only contact area driving. And you see that, indeed, you have a velocity direction from right to left. So this is not the direction, but just the following side. The other thing is it also strongly depends on the vibrating frequency. So if you vibrate, so this is the period of the vibration. If this becomes too large, this driving through the contact area stops. Okay. And then once this stopped, only the contact angle hysteresis survive. So droplets move even at larger periods than that, but the driving mechanism is different.
Can you tell something about the effects of frequency? So low frequency, high frequency, and the velocity.
Right. I mean, you see this, I mean, so these are the, I mean, the periods, right? So the inverse of the frequency. So this is a short period, high frequency. The effect is larger, and then it decreases as the period becomes larger. You can also look at the velocity, center of mass velocity of the droplets as a function of this period.
But for low frequency, this is for low frequency, velocity decreases, but yeah. It should also decrease for high frequency, I guess.
This is not
if
what
you will do just very, very rapidly start to shake, then the droplet will not have time, enough time to...
Yeah, okay. We didn't go. I mean, I agree. We didn't go into this. I mean, it's still the typical relaxation times of the Lennard-Jones liquid. You see, sort of, this is the center of mass velocity versus the period of driving. So in this regime here, you have both driving mechanisms, the contact area and the three-phase contact line, the hysteresis. And there you see that as the droplets become larger, also the velocity becomes larger. So sort of because the area gives energy input proportional to the area. While in this case here, I mean, within this factor of 10 range of the droplet size, the velocity is independent from the droplet size, and this is only where the contact line contributes to the drive. Okay. The other thing, and this we didn't understand, but I just want to put it up, maybe you have a good idea. The velocity profile inside of the droplets is very different, whether you have this finely corrugated substrate or the coarsely corrugated substrate. So in one case, with a fine corrugation, you have sort of like, I mean, it moves homogeneously, right? This also dissipates very little. That's fine. In the other case, with a rough corrugation, you have this rolling motion. That is like Huygens rotation. That also dissipates little. But, I mean, there's a striking difference, and we don't understand where it comes from. So I would be happy to discuss it.
Do you have some change of shape?
There's
some sort of protrusion into the direction against the motion, and maybe change of shape?
No, not really. I mean, the contact angle changes slightly with the period. That's true. I mean, sort of basically they lift up a little bit the droplet and the contact angle, I believe, become, I mean, they move it, so it becomes higher. But sort of we didn't see much sort of left-right asymmetry. That's what you meant, right? No. Yeah. I mean, they're low against the relaxation times. Mm-hmm. That's true. And then we looked at the different dissipation mechanisms. So, of course, you can look at what is the energy you put into the system. And there you just take the force between the solid and the liquid and the microscope and the velocity of the surface. And, of course, at small periods, it's large, and at large periods, it's small. That also qualitatively explains how that the velocity the center of mass decreases. And then you have various different dissipation mechanisms. The most important one for large droplets, of course, the viscous dissipation of the flow inside of the droplet. And since we can measure the velocity profile, and this is a hydrodynamic velocity profile, so averaged over many, many periods for each phase, and then averaging over the phase. That sort of contributes to a constant fraction of this input power. A constant independent of the absolute value. And it, for large periods, when you have the contact line driving, this is 80% of the dissipation. And then you have the friction at the substrate, and that we can measure as well. We can calculate the friction coefficient just with the techniques we had before. That's also a constant, but it's less than this one. It's about 15%. Then we have something curious, which are sound waves. Since it's a compressible liquid, if you move up, you sort of have a compression wave, which sort of dies out as it goes. It's only 5% of that, and it's 5% of the input value. And then sort of we have all those ones we have not accounted for. And there are two of them, I mean, contact line contributions, which in the motion of droplets people are very fond of. We don't see much there, and we didn't see much for rolling droplets either. And our explanation for this is just dimension, right? I mean, so this is proportional to the volume, this is proportional to the area, and if you have something at the contact line, it's just one dimension less. So you should not see this. And also we were worried sort of whether sort of there's direct dissipation into the thermostat. Since we have this DPD thermostat, you could just do this. But those two are very small at large periods, and it is somewhat larger here, but it does not. I mean, it is the contact line contribution rather than the sum star. Okay, and with this, I'm at the end. I just put up sort of summary conclusion. So we looked at the static properties like surface tension and interface potential, and then you can use this in this interface Hamiltonian to look at deviations from the cup-shaped droplets. And the point there was that you can use the anisotropy of the pressure to calculate it rather than grand canonical simulation than what was done before. Then we had this dynamic properties where we looked at friction and slip. And there the point was that by the two flow profiles, squared and Poisson, you can determine both the position as well as the slip lengths. And that's important for these soft interfaces where you don't, where you can't immediately guess where the interface is. It fails if the surface viscosity is high. Then you have this flow inversion inside of the polymer brush. You get this crossover between the macroscopic topography and roughness for these finer corrugations. And we looked at this different dissipation mechanisms and movements on this asymmetric vibrating surface. And with this, I'm at my end, and thank you for your attention.
Yeah, thank you very much for this excursion into interfacial phenomena. And although it might look a bit far away from active matter, but active particles move in a liquid at a small scale, we can't do these kind of phenomena there. So it's just a question of resolution when you're facing these kind of phenomena. Questions?
So it occurs about the granulated bottom. If it's you were showing always regular patterns, so if you have irregular structures of some sort, have you studied how that changes?
No, we didn't do that. Right. I don't have a good feeling for what it would do. I mean, it depends how different they would be, right?
Yeah.
If you would have sort of a hierarchical roughness, it would change things because, I mean, if you look at this example of the hydrodynamic boundary condition, right, then it was important on which length scale you disturb the velocity profile in the vicinity. And I could imagine that there is something interesting. People look with lattice Boltzmann with this, but they place the hydrodynamic boundary condition between the top and the bottom. I don't think this is.
Another thing occurs about it is, do you know about these equation free approach of Yannis, Kiriki? Have you tried to sometimes use some of these approaches, like to divide out, some of these continuation methods you can do when you do the approximation?
Yes, but in a different context. I guess the closest related to this talk is, when we looked at the minimum free energy path of the filling, right? And these simulations by Alberto, which I haven't shown, the Ginzburg-Landau thing, they use this equation-free approach. There's a technique how you can get the free energy functional, so to say, on the fly, from these techniques. And we use this in order to look at something like Lipschitz-Yossoff growth, where you couple the particle-based model to a Ginzburg-Landau model. The Ginzburg-Landau model can easily propagate, and then you can drag the particle-based model behind. And you use sort of an umbrella potential at each point in space, both to estimate the parameter of the Ginzburg-Landau model, as well as you don't want to reinitialize the particle-based simulation. But if you sort of impose this umbrella potential with a stiff spring, that creates a strong force which sort of drags the particle-based system to the new configuration of the physical number.
Could you put on one of your early files, bytes concerning the slip length? There you had an explicit expression for the proportionality.
The one from Barani.
Okay. Yeah. This is it. Yeah. Now, there have been efforts to relate this also to the angle.
Yeah.
What's the latest on that?
Well, I'm not sure what the latest on this, but I mean, I can easily construct. Yes, I mean, but I mean, as you can see already in this formula, this is not the only parameter, right? You can easily construct a surface which has a contact angle you can tune and which has perfect slippage. So, I mean, the statement then is that in experimental systems, by some magic, you have a sort of correlation between the strength of the attraction and structure factor at this corrugation. But I mean, at least in computer simulations, I can certainly break this correlation easily.
Mm-hmm. So, Nix and Kim, they played that and it was a bit of a surprise and found a power law.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean,
okay. So
maybe some magic of water. At least mathematically, I can construct a surface which breaks this correlation.
As long as the water has no memory, things are fine. Have you made an effort, say, also to get access to the line tension? Object of its own desire?
Yes. People, Andrei Milchev, for example, of course, look at how the contact angle depends on droplet size, and from this you could extract the line tension contribution. And it may be interesting to sort of compare it to this interface potential, because you could use this Indicator construction in order to extract from there the line tension as well. We haven't done that, but I mean, it would be an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe rather Tolman length than line tension.
Well, you need actually to know the Tolman length in order to be able to identify the line tension. So this is a pretty delicate
thing.
Yeah, it looks so. Okay. It's fine. So once more, thank you very much.